corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. It is a beautiful day, gray and rainy here in the People's Republic of Vermont. Soon we will be broadcasting from the People's Republic of Oregon. That'll be entertaining. Heading out the end of this week. The first non-Italian pope since 1523 has passed on. And it's sort of, you know, the news coverage is sort of all pope all the time. And but there, I do have a take on this, and I want to share it with you, and a couple of insights that I think you may find valuable or useful or interesting. But first of all, Pope John Paul II, Carol Wojtyla, 1523, Adrian VI was the last non-Italian pope. And I say that he came, Adrian VI came to power because when the Habsburgs came to power, Emperor Charles V, he used his influence to elevate this guy, who was a Dutchman, by the way, to the papacy, because he had been the tutor of Emperor Charles V when Emperor Charles V had been a child. And so his priest, who was also his teacher, he helped him become pope. That, of course, 500 years ago. And now this, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens. My take on this comes out of having actually met the Pope and spoken with him and shaken his hand. And some interesting story, a funny story, and a somewhat tragic story. And I think that they are all commentaries on the nature of spirituality, on the nature of we as people, on the nature of Catholicism. And, you know, the whole idea of the Catholic Church as the last remnant, really, of the Roman Empire, which, in my opinion, it very much is. The Roman Empire is still alive and well. It has simply changed its name to the Catholic Church. And I don't mean that as a negative or a positive, just as an observation. First, I'll tell you this story. I had written a book some years ago, in fact, I think it was in 95 or 96, called The Prophet's Way, and this book is actually, the title of the book has nothing to do with prophecy. There is a path in the woods in Germany that a dear friend of mine, who is now 92 years old, Gottfried Müller, walks every day, and it's where he says his prayers. It's about a mile-long path through the forest in Stadtsteinach, Germany. Herr Müller is the founder of a German international relief organization called Kinder- und Jugendhilfswerksalem that I first became affiliated with in 1978. They were looking for somebody to do some advertising and promotion for them, and they hired me, and it was a whole long series of weird coincidences. And I ended up basically volunteering for them for the last 27 years. Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village, based on their model in Germany. We ran that for 5 years. I'm still, in fact, this year I'm president of the board of directors. And anyhow, I wrote this book mostly about Herr Müller, about this man who has been one of my mentors and an extraordinary guy. He's sort of the Father Flanagan of Europe. Everybody in Germany knows who he is. And back in the 50s or 60s, there was a woman by the name of Monica Juhar who had worked with him as a volunteer. She was Italian. And Dr. Monica, she has a PhD in something. And so she knew Herr Müller. And she had since married a man who was a bit older than her, Giuseppe Juhar, who was one of the Pope's best friends when he was growing up in Poland, as I heard the story. So anyhow, I sent a case of these books, The Prophet's Way, after I wrote it, and it was published. It's in print right now. Random House first published it. Now it's in print with Park Street Press. And to Herr Müller in Germany, and said, "Hey, you know, you're famous now. I wrote a book about you, and about our experiences, you know, and going into Uganda and the war there, and being shot at in the middle of that, and going into Colombia and seeing meeting the paramilitaries who were hunting street children for sport, and just, you know, ups and downs all around the world. And Herr Müller sent a copy of this book out to a number of his old friends, including Monika Juhar. She read it and said to her husband, Giuseppe, hey, we've got to invite this guy over to Italy. Well, Giuseppe, he had put together this program. He's Protestant, and he had put together a program with his old friend, Karol Wojtyla, the Pope, who is now Pope John Paul II, or was, you know, until 2 days ago, had put together this annual gig where they would take Castle Gandolfo, which was the Pope's summer palace. It's right on the rim of an ancient extinct volcano, which is now filled with water. It's a lake. And they invite the Pope this fellow Giuseppe Juhar, invite Catholics and Protestants to this in a way of trying to bring together Catholics and Protestants, right? And they have a concert, and they invite a few hundred people, and there'll be maybe a half a dozen or a dozen dignitaries who are invited, and they're invited, these dignitaries are invited to have a private audience with the Pope, and you get to talk with him and shake his hand or kiss his ring if you're Catholic and have your photo taken with him. And so... And so, anyhow, Louise and I come home, and I didn't know about all this stuff. I come home, and here coming out of on the fax machine is this fax from the Vatican that says you're hereby officially invited for a private audience with His Holiness Pope John Paul II at Castle Gandolfo on this particular date. It was in August, as I recall, of about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And at first, I thought it was a practical joke. You know, what is this about? You know, I've been invited to a private audience with the Pope. So I called the phone number in Italy. And sure enough, it was the Vatican. And sure enough, I had been invited as one of those dignitaries to have a private meeting with the Pope as a result of this book that I wrote that Monika had shared with her husband and he had talked with the Pope about. And so Louise and I went over, and initially... Louise was told that she could come with me, but that she couldn't meet the Pope. That she was a woman and she wasn't a high profile dignitary. Sitting to my left, when we sat there for the concert, we were sitting about 20 feet from the Pope. Sitting to my left was the head of the German Parliament, the Bundestag. Sitting to my right was the president of the National Bank of Italy. I mean, it was, you know, thank you, Rama. It was some pretty impressive bunch. And we sat through this two-hour concert, and then afterwards, the I don't know, 15 of us or so, I've got a whole video of it that the Vatican did and sent to me, were brought up and one by one had an opportunity to speak with the Pope. And at that time, he was already quite Parkinsoned. He was trembling, but he had a ferocious grip. This is a very strong-willed man. And here we were standing in front of this 9-foot-tall statue of St. Peter, was standing right behind the Pope, and he had this big wooden gold throne that he sat on through the concert and that he then stood up from to meet us. And St. Peter had in one hand the keys to heaven and in the other hand a book, you know, the book of life. And all around us were all the trappings of not just Catholicism, but really of the Roman Empire. And that was the moment when I really got it, that this really was the last remnant of the Roman Empire. And it was quite an experience. It was a remarkable experience, and we had a very brief conversation, which is very private, and I'm not going to share. And he gave me a rosary, and there was a bishop standing next to him, or whatever it was, one of these guys. I don't know I'm not Catholic. I was raised Protestant. And and he handed us a rosary, and off we went. In fact, I still have it with me. It's about 5 feet from me at this moment. And so, anyhow, here's the funny story. Before I left, I had a barber in this little town in Vermont where I was living, who was Italian. In fact, he goes back to Italy every year. He's literally Italian. I mean, he's an Italian immigrant. I think he's a U.S. citizen now, but he speaks with a thick Italian accent. He waves his hands around whenever he tells stories. And so I go in to get a haircut, right? I've got this invitation. I'm going to see the Pope. And so I go into this to get a haircut. And here we are in this little town in the middle of nowhere. And he says, what do you want today? And I said, well, make it look kind of nice. I'm going to go meet the Pope. And he goes, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He says, what, are you taking a tour of Italy? And I said, no, I'm just going over to see the Pope. And he says, yeah, I met the Pope. He says, I saw the Pope three times. I was over there three different times I saw the Pope. I said, oh, really? And he says, yeah. I said, one time I was in St. Peter's Square, and he came out. It was Easter, and he blessed everybody. And another time it was, you know, and he had, and it was like three of these things where he'd been part of a crowd of 100,000 people. And he assumed that I was, that's what I was doing, right? And so I, you know, I didn't say anything. I didn't correct him. And I just got my, and then he says, hey, I got a joke, a Pope joke. And I, you know, he never told me a joke before. So I was like, okay. And he says, this guy goes to see the Pope. And when the Pope reaches out his, oh, it's a barber joke, by the way. He says, I went to my barber. He says, this guy goes to his barber and he gets the best haircut he can get. He says, give me the very best haircut. I'm going to see the Pope. And so his barber gives him the very best haircut he can get. And his barber is like so meticulous, but he's not really the best barber, you know. So anyhow, the guy goes to see the Pope, and when he bows down to kiss his ring, you know, you've got to kiss his ring, it's St. Peter's ring, he bows down to kiss his ring, and the Pope looks down in the back of his head, and the Pope says to him, where did you get that terrible haircut? And then my barber starts laughing and, you know, waving his hands around in the air and like this, you know, and that was his joke. All right. So anyhow, about a week after I get back from Italy, an envelope comes in the mail. And again, I wasn't expecting this. I mean, when I was shaking his hand, there was a Vatican photographer clicking away. But this envelope comes with all these pictures of me and the Pope and Louise and the Pope, too. They ultimately let Louise come up and shake his hand as well. And so next time I went down to get a haircut, I took along a picture of me shaking hands with the Pope John Paul II. And I walked in and then he says, hey, how was your meeting with the Pope? And I said, oh, it was fine. And I hand him the picture. And he looks at and he takes the picture in his hand. It's one of these 8x12 glossies. And his hands actually started to tremble. And he says, you really met the Pope? And I said, yeah. Yeah, I did. He says, you shook his hand. I said, yeah, I did. He says, you talked with him? And I said, yeah. And he says, what did he say? And I said, well, you know, when I bent down to kiss his ring, he looked down at the back of my head and he said, who gave you that terrible haircut? And for just a moment, for maybe 5 seconds, there was this look of absolute panic on my barber's face. And then he remembered that that was the joke he had told me. He goes, oh, you got me. And so anyway, I left. You know, I had a bunch of these pictures. I had a copy made and I left it with him. And everybody who comes in now to his barbershop, he goes, I cut the hair of the guy who met the Pope, you know, the one guy in Vermont. So, but there's also a tragedy associated with the Pope. Before I went over there, I read Crossing the Threshold of Hope, which was a book that he had published in 1995. And I want to share that with you and a little bit of an insight about the Pope's experience of mysticism and others and how this might relate to modern life. This is Tom Hartman, 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, where democracy will not be downsized. Before I continue talking about my experience of meeting the Pope and just my sense of this guy, I want to share with you, and this, as I said, this is sort of the tragedy of the Pope. I also want to tell you a story about meeting the head Catholic in Colombia, which was a scary experience. But first, what about the mystical experience? The Pope wrote this book, Crossing the Threshold of Hope, which I read just before I went over to meet him. And I want to come back to that. But, I mean, the book has some, like, really tough questions. Some of the chapters, you know, is God real? Why is God hiding from us? Things like that. And I want to share with you the story of a friend of mine who lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. His name is Michael Hutchison. Michael is an author, and I've known Michael for a decade or more. And, in fact, this is Michael's story on my website. This is from a little piece that he wrote. And he talks about how this was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. He went for a run. He says, it was a long run, about 2 hours, and I got caught in a snowstorm. He says, I was heading for home, crossing a footbridge across the Santa Fe River, and I slipped on an ice patch and fell head over heels a long distance down into the rocky riverbed. My neck and the back of my head smashed into the rocks. I broke my spine. I was laying there in the icy waters, paralyzed from the neck down, and with only my face out of the water. Now, to make a long story short, somebody found Michael. They got him in an ambulance. They got him to a hospital. But he was paralyzed from the neck down. He says, the doctors told me I could expect to be a quadriplegic for the rest of my life. He goes on to say, my money had run out, and I did not have any medical insurance. My only course of action, and so he's getting a little bit of movement back in his arms and legs, but that's about it. He says, my only course of action was to get admitted to a very grim nursing home. It was dark, noisy, overcrowded, the hallways jammed with sickly, frail people, mainly in their 80s and 90s, vegetating in wheelchairs or just milling around, many of them advanced Alzheimer's patients who had no idea where they were. People were wandering around, shouting, screaming, yelling for help. The screaming never let up. Amazingly, many people screamed right up to the moment they died. He says, as I think about it, it was like something right out of Dante's Inferno. During the first year I was there, I truly bottomed out. I felt depressed, and I couldn't seem to think very clearly. Now, Michael had, before this happened, a long history of exploring spiritual traditions. And, in fact, he says, I had been driven all my life by a deep longing to wake up, to awaken from the dream of life to a higher, more real reality. The whole point, I saw, was to attain not just a brief taste, but permanent enlightenment. I'd always wanted to spend time in a monastery, so I decided to look at being confined there in my wheelchair as being confined to a monastery or a retreat. I started spending many hours every day, 8, 10, 12 hours, doing intense meditation. With all the shouting and the screams of the people and people wandering around, I had to shut down my hearing, so I wasn't paying attention to it. Much of the time, my roommate would have the TV playing, so I had to ignore that, too. I closed my eyes. Months passed, and I had some very interesting experiences, visions, images, floods of white light, movies in my head, thoughts and ideas, but it was not enlightenment, because these were all things. After months of frustration, he writes, it began to hit me. The voice in my head said, let go, man, let go. Look at how you're holding on. What do you think life's telling you? All these near-death experiences, what do you think it's all about? Dying, that's what. You keep hanging on to life like you're afraid to let go. It's time to die. I realized my ego, Michael writes, which is to say myself, was holding on, trying to maintain control. I knew it was time for the ego to let go. It was like my entire being had been clenched in a tight fist, and suddenly the fist opened up and let go completely. Everything dropped away. All contractions released and disappeared. Contraction of the mind, of the body, of the emotions. The way it happened was they had come to take me for a shower. They wheeled me down the hallway and hosed me off. And for a time, I forgot about meditating and seeking. And as they wheeled me back from the room, I suddenly found things began to happen. I'm going to share Michael's experience with you and then relate that to John Paul's search for this experience in just a moment. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Life Support System for Democracy in America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. After months of frustration, it began to hit me, writes Michael Hutchison. The way it happened was, just at this point, they came to take me for a shower. This is my friend Michael, who has broke his neck. He's paralyzed from the neck down. He's in a nursing home in Santa Fe, living on Social Security, by the way, and hoping that George Bush doesn't cut it. He says, as they wheeled me back to the room, I suddenly found things begin to happen. At first, it was radiance within me. I began seeing and experiencing this upwelling or emanation. It was in front of my eyes, but also inside my eyes and inside my body. This radiance began flowing upward. It was like a spring welling up, but it was welling up out of infinite emptiness. As this continued to happen, I realized it was bliss. It was just a current of bliss. Over the next few hours, it became more and more intense. As the days went by, I began to realize that I was existing in a sea of bliss, which we could also call consciousness or spirit or God. Everything around me was bliss. The simplest beingness of being was bliss. It was fun to be alive every moment. I began to feel this bliss all around me. I was experiencing being like a fish swimming in water, suddenly realizing that he's in water. Everything that happened in that bliss was totally effortless. I found that my actions became effortless too. When I lifted up my hand, for example, it wasn't me lifting my hand. It was just this consciousness or bliss acting through me. I realized that I wasn't doing my life, but that I was being lived through by consciousness. I wasn't breathing, but I was being breathed through. I wasn't thinking, I was being thought through. I wasn't seeing, I was being seen through. When you look at it this way, everything is happening just the way it is. Everything is perfect just the way it is. There's no need to worry about anything because whatever's going to happen, happens. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Sermon on the Mount, this really reflects on the very end, you know, in Jesus' wrap-up of the Sermon on the Mount, not to get too theological here on you. Anyhow, Michael says, now it became clear to me that this kind of awakening of being lived through by consciousness was not a peak experience. It wasn't rare. It wasn't even really an experience. It was just the condition of being, the nature of reality, the primary innermost essence. Far from being rare, this pure consciousness is always here, always the same, never changes, never moves, and is constantly going on no matter what experiences you may be having. You may be having an experience of pain, and this consciousness is still there with you. You would be having an experience of carrying on a conversation, and the consciousness is still there. You have it every instant of your life, every moment of your life, but you're just not aware of it. Actually, it's not an experience. It's prior to experience. When you have an experience, there's someone there having the experience. In pure consciousness, the one who experiences goes away. One way I can describe it is that time disappears. When time disappears, Michael Hutchison writes, you're in a place where there's no inside and no outside. There's no center and no edge. There's no before and no after. No past and no future. Just now. This space is essentially formless, limitless, and very clear, open, empty, alive, and still. Radiant and alive, but totally still. A paradox, but that's how it is. It's just bliss or pure consciousness or God. And this is, you know, Michael Hutchison describing his experience of this. He said, this primordial awareness is reality. It's totally real, totally natural, effortless, and closer to you than your own breath. He said, it was clear to me that these techniques are not airy-fairy or cloaked in the smoke and mirror of religions, but tried and true, radically direct, and totally experiential. They have been successfully used in waking people up for centuries. He said, it got clear whether my eyes were open or closed, this consciousness was always there. It was experiencing what Dzogchen calls direct seeing. It's like an infinite vastness inside yourself. The world becomes more real than real. It takes on a higher dimension, so to speak. And then Michael wraps up this piece. You can find it at tomhartmann.com. If you go to, I'm not sure how to get there, the URL is /Hutchison, HUTCHISON.SHTML. He then in the very end, it's a Q&A, and they ask him, you know, well, how's everything now? He says, everything's okay. All is well. He said, one master said, there is a mysterious power that is continuously aware that all is well. What we call the I is just an image superimposed on that power. Anyhow, whatever has happened to me and whatever will happen to me, I'm always aware that all is well and that I am merely an image superimposed on this mysterious power. So are you. So is everyone. This mysterious power, of course, is consciousness, pure awareness. This consciousness is the same in everyone. Not the same, like identical consciousness in everyone, but it's absolutely the same one thing. It's one thing only. It's all one thing. We're all this one thing. And then he says, so to sum it up, I'm a quadriplegic. I live in poverty on Social Security. I'm the happiest man on earth. That was Michael's experience. So then I read this Crossing the Threshold of Hope, this book by the Pope. And one of the questions, and it's a Q&A actually, it's a, the actual person who wrote the book asks him questions and he answers them. And one of the questions is, if God exists, why is he hiding? Now, I knew from what I knew of the Pope that he had read Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross. He'd read Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. He had read The Little Flowers of St. Francis, the stories of St. Francis of Assisi, books that I had all read when I was in my teenage years and in my early 20s, the stories of the early mystics of Christianity, who all experienced and described something identical to what Michael did. In Dark Night of the Soul, St. John of the Cross talks about this experience of the light. In fact, I have a quote from that in one of my books that translated from the Spanish. I mean, St. John wrote in Spanish. St. Teresa, who was St. John of the Cross's mentor, he got in trouble because he was supporting her attempts to reform the Catholic Church. She started the Carmelite Order. In Interior Castle, she talks about having this experience. St. Francis talks about having this experience. One of my favorite books, The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence, a 16th century French monk. He didn't even get to be a priest. Brother Lawrence was the dishwasher in the monastery. He has this experience, like Michael's experience. And he starts writing, and he thinks he doesn't know what to make of it, so he writes a letter to the abbot. And there's a series of, because he's so low in the pecking order in the monastery, he can't actually talk to the abbot. So he has to correspond with him. And the abbot gets it, that Brother Lawrence has had this experience that the abbot his whole life has been trying to have. And there's this marvelous correspondence, which is still in print today, from the 16th century dishwasher and the abbot of the monastery about how to achieve this space, this place. And what I got from reading Crossing the Threshold of Hope is that Karol Wojtyla, Pope John Paul II, had devoted his entire life to trying to have that experience and had not yet had it. And there's certainly a lot of bittersweet sadness in this book about this, and perhaps even a little bit of bitterness. I don't want to imagine his feelings, but well, for example, you know, the questioner says, "If God exists, why is he hiding?" And the Pope writes, "I think the way I think because I am that which I am, a creature, and because he is who he is, the uncreated absolute mystery. If he were not a mystery, there would be no need for revelation, or more precisely, no need for God to reveal himself." So he's talking about we have to know this because it's been written down by people who experienced it. And see, if he had had Michael's experience, he would have said in answer to that question, "Well, I know there's a God because I have experienced the presence of this, whatever you want to call it." And then the questioner says, "Why does he seem to hide himself, almost playing with his creation? Shouldn't it be simpler? Shouldn't his existence be obvious?" And Pope John Paul says, "When you speak of playing, I think of the words in the book of Proverbs, which show wisdom playing among the sons of man on the surface of the earth. Doesn't this mean that the wisdom of God bestows itself upon all creatures, while at the same time not revealing to them all his mystery?" And then he says, "Even before the Passion, the apostles asked Christ, 'Show us the Father.' His response remains fundamental. 'How can you say, show me the Father? Do you not believe that I am the Father and the Father in me? I and the Father are one.'" And then the Pope says, "Christ's words are far reaching. We are almost at the point of that. We are almost," he writes, "we are almost at the point of," and then this is in italics, "that direct experience," end of italics, "to which contemporary man aspires." And so here's a man who devoted his entire life to this experience. And as he was dying this weekend, that morning that he died, I remember thinking, I've had conversations with a few people who have had this experience that Michael has had. I've gotten close to it myself a few times in my life. Herr Mueller, in my opinion, hangs out there most of the time. And I've talked with a few people who have had near-death experiences, and I turned to Louise and I said, he's now having it, the experience that he's worked for his whole life as he goes into the light. I'm absolutely and utterly convinced that at the end of life we go into that light. And I think it's just an absolutely marvelous and extraordinary thing. And the other thing is that the Pope was very political. Now I've done, you know, this is the end of my religious thing. Laborum exercens. I don't know if I'm pronouncing the Latin. I took 2 years of Latin, but it was 40 years ago. Laborum exercens is a piece that he wrote in 1981. And in it, the Pope calls for social justice in the context of encouraging labor unions and the whole question, what he calls the worker question and the proletariat question. He says that the call to solidarity and common action addressed to the workers, especially to those engaged in narrowly specialized, monotonous, and depersonalized work in industrial plants, is important and eloquent from the point of view of social ethics. And he's actually, I've got this all marked up here, but rather than reading it to you, because it is rather erudite, just the bottom line is that this guy said, right up front, capitalism in an unconstrained, laissez-faire fashion, the neocon capitalism of Wolfowitz, that Wolfowitz imposed on Iraq, that George W. Bush would like to impose on the United States, where there is no social safety net, where there are no unions, where workers have no protections, where war has been declared on the working class. This, the Pope said, is a crime against humanity. And just explicitly. And what amazes me is that his writings on this, which are extensive, and his speakings on this, I mean, this was one of the things that brought down communism, was his going to Poland and taking this position with Lech Walesa that laborers had a right to organize, independent of the state and independent of their employer. In the case of Poland, the state was their employer. That workers have a right to organize. That it is for all practical purposes a God-given right. And it was the beginning of the end of communism. Well, it wasn't the beginning of the end of communism. It was the straw that broke the camel's back for communism. Communism had been on a long, what we call communism, of the USSR, let's say. It had been on a long decline since the late 60s. And, of course, the Republicans, the right-wingers now, are running around hysterically trying to say, no, Reagan brought down communism. No, just don't talk about the Pope bringing down communism. It's so sad. It's so sad. They really want Reagan to have that legacy. Anyhow, I encourage you, Laborum Exercens, Laborem Exercens, if you type that into Google, you can read the whole thing. It's 38 pages. But it's brilliant, this writing. In fact, I intend to write a piece for Common Dreams based on this. It's absolutely brilliant about the rights of humans to organize and to be paid a decent wage. And in it, he calls for a living wage, not just a minimum wage, but a fair wage that's enough for a person to raise their children, enough so that a family can survive on the income of one worker, enough that children can be put through school. I mean, it's just very, very straightforward. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Oh, you're very heavy this morning, Tom, but very, very interesting. I was wondering, you left the story of Adrian the VI hanging there. Do you know why he was the last non-Italian pope until Pope John the Second here?
Well, my assumption is that he was the last non-Italian pope because the Catholic Church is the last remnant of the Roman Empire, which is headquartered in Rome. But is there a reason that you know that I don't know?
Yes, it's quite an interesting story because he had never been to the Vatican. He was in Holland when he got elected, and they summoned him. And when he got to the Vatican, he was appalled at the paintings on the ceilings of the Sistine Chapel in the Basilica, and he made a decision. He ordered that painters come in and paint it over in flat white, and so all the cardinals and the artists were appalled at this and decided that his reign should be a very short one. So they stabbed him, and he recovered, and they stabbed him again, and he recovered, and they poisoned him, and he recovered, and they poisoned him again, and they finally killed him. And all the cardinals decided, we cannot take that chance again.
Oh, that's interesting.
We will have Italians who will appreciate this art.
that's remarkable. Dave, thanks for sharing that with me. I've got to move along. I appreciate the story. It's great to hear from you. Jerry in Palm Harbor, Florida. Fascinating things we're learning today, eh, Jerry?
Yeah, that was interesting. I tell you, I have something interesting to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe any one generation of people have a greater right to the use of the planet than succeeding generations. God didn't make a plan like that. So what does that mean? Well,
you'll find that the Pope agrees with you on that.
Yeah, All right, that's good. I didn't know that. But something else should be noted. Sydney, Australia doesn't have any slums. It's the most beautiful city in the world.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Sydney.
Well, have you asked how come those buildings are up? And are they so smart that they can do that? And why don't other cities do it? Well, if you don't know that they don't tax buildings, you're not going to know why those buildings are up.
Yeah, well, actually, there are very poor parts of Sydney, and they're mostly inhabited by Aboriginal people.
That's right. That's the buildings that are abandoned.
Yeah.
But the business people don't abandon new buildings, and if it does, the
yeah.
Aborigines
I'm, do I'm missing your point, Jerry. We've got about 5 seconds. Can you quickly illuminate this for me?
Well, Alaska has $28 billion in their state treasury. They collect when oil is drilled for.
I'm sorry, Jerry. I'm out of time and I don't get it. But I appreciate the try. 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Santa Cruz, California.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Come, writers and critics, you prophesize with your pen. And keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, we must, first of all, recall a principle that has always been taught by the church, the principle of the priority of labor over capital. Our quote of the day from Pope John Paul II. He says, in order to achieve social justice in the various parts of the world, in the various countries, and in the relationships between them, there is a need for every new movement of solidarity of the workers and with the workers. This solidarity must be present whenever it is called for by the social degrading of the subject of work, by exploitation of the workers, and by the growing areas of poverty and even hunger. The Church is firmly committed to this cause, for she considers it her mission, her service, a proof of her fidelity to Christ, so that she can be truly the Church of the poor. Pope John Paul II. Logan in New York on the line. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to challenge you on one of the points you made in We the People, because I was looking up the word fascism in the dictionary, or in the encyclopedia, and I saw nothing about this alliance between corporations. It seemed like more it was, and government. It seemed more of just an issue of like kind of an autocracy.
Yeah.
So I was wondering where you were getting that definition.
That definition was from the 1984 edition of the American Heritage Dictionary.
Oh, okay.
And you will find that if you go into a library and you look at dictionaries or encyclopedias published before Reagan, before all the big mergers and acquisitions, and that were published by independent small publishers, You will find that definition because it's the definition that Mussolini used. Or for that matter, go on the web and just type in Mussolini and fascism, and you will find, he invented the word. And that's what the meaning of the word was. And then in the late 80s, after Reagan, after all these mergers and acquisitions and all these smaller independent encyclopedia and dictionary companies got bought up, somehow the definition of fascism has changed. And now it means dictatorship.
Yeah, that's the only point. And also about
it's
the
very
Pope.
Strange. It's very strange.
The Pope also said that one of his last words was that abortion was like the Holocaust. So I don't know why people quote the Pope. I think he was misguided. Anyway,
well,
thanks for your
thanks a lot for your call, Logan. I appreciate it. There's some areas where I disagree with the Pope, some areas where I agree with him, but I think that on this day, it's useful to remember him in a positive light for the good things that he did. Although we can also talk about the problem. Actually, enough. Let's get back to politics in the next hour of the program. Enough on the Pope. God bless him and rest his soul and all those appropriate things. This is Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare ask the question, is Walmart a person? No, I don't think so. Don't think so at all. No soul there.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our live chat room and visit with some of the most erudite, insightful, thoughtful, perceptive, witty, and occasionally strange minds in the entire world of cyberspace. 7 minutes past the hour, the so-called bankruptcy reform bill, which the Dirty 18 senators, Democratic senators, voted for, plus Jim Jeffords, my formerly Republican senator, has gone from the Senate to the House and will probably come for consideration in the House this week. Vote could come as early as the as Wednesday of this week. And so I wanted to get David Swanson on. He runs a website called debtslavery.org. He's also on the board of Progressive Democrats of America. And also has his own website, davidswanson.org. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
David, what's the deal here with the bankruptcy bill? What's the latest conventional wisdom on it? Is this, you know, I've been hearing kind of seesawing reports. The number one, that the Democrats in the Senate had no idea what kind of whiplash, backlash they were going to experience when they voted for it, and now they're all regretting it. And then on the other hand, I've heard that, you know, they're just happy with their campaign contributions and figure it'll blow away, and they've got a year and a half before there's an election, and they don't have anything to worry about. And that Democrats in the House are thinking one or the other of these same things. You know, which is it? What's going on?
Well, I can't speak for the senators. I haven't seen any of them publicly express regret. But I have been in communication with some of the offices of the House members, and it's really, really grim. And the push that we're making on them is going to have to pick up considerably.
Grim meaning meaning they're taking money from the banks and they're saying, hey, this is a wonderful bill.
The minority whip, Steny Hoyer, the Democratic minority whip who's supposed to organize Democrats, has not taken a position, is not interested in getting Democrats together against this bill. And, you know, it's absolutely...
Which state is Steny Hoyer from? What's it?
He's from right in my neighborhood in Maryland, suburban Maryland.
So if
you don't mind, I'd love to give out his phone number.
Well, in fact, let me give out the phone number for all of Congress. You can simply call this number and ask for Steny Hoyer, or you can ask for your local congressman as well. So that way people can get all of them. And it's a toll-free number. It's 1-877-SOB. U, the letter U, S-O-B. 1-877-S-O-B-U-S-O-B. That's the telephone number for the Capitol in Washington, D.C. It'll get you through to the White House, the Senate, or the House of Representatives. Just ask for your member of Congress or for your senator. And if you don't know who your member of Congress is, odds are they can help you figure it out. So how's that, David?
That's terrific. I love that number.
Yeah. It's somebody's got a sense of humor there. The real number is 1-877-782-8762. But that's S-O-B-U-S-O-B. So
that's terrific.
Yeah.
It's looking like there are Democrats who are going to take a lot of pushing before they're willing to vote against the credit card companies. And
yeah. It's not just the credit card companies. You know, the big auto manufacturers have gotten into this because there's a provision in the bankruptcy bill that the big automakers, and it's not even just the American big automakers now, I mean, who are big in the United States, have gotten in here because they're doing, a lot of them are doing their own financing now. They are their own banks. And what they're, under the old bankruptcy law, you had to, if you went into Chapter 13, you know, where you're paying back your debts over time and all that kind of thing, under the old bankruptcy law, you had to pay back the value, up to the value of your vehicle. And
right.
Which means that, you know, you buy a car, say you take a $20,000 loan on a $25,000 car just to arbitrarily pull numbers out of the air, As soon as you drive it off the lot, that car's not worth, well, let's say you take a $20,000 loan on a $20,000 car. As soon as you drive that car off the lot, it's not worth $20,000 anymore. It's now worth maybe $17,000 or $16,000 because there's this instant depreciation as soon as it becomes a used car. And under the old bank, the existing bankruptcy law, you would only have to pay back up to what the car is worth. Under the new bankruptcy law, you have to pay back every penny that you signed for. Now, you could argue that there's a certain logic to that, and it's not unreasonable if somebody actually is going to try to pay back all of their debts that they actually pay back all of their debts. I have no problem with that. But the fact of the matter is that there are a whole bunch of these little kinds of things buried in this that benefits specific interest groups other than just banks and credit card companies. And I suspect that one of the reasons why there's so much support for this bankruptcy legislation is that there's also the protection for rich people in the bankruptcy protection, in the bankruptcy bill. They keep intact asset protection trusts. So if you're wealthy, you put your money into an asset protection trust, then you declare bankruptcy, and when you come out of bankruptcy, you can take your money back out of the trust and you still have it. And, you know, that only works for millionaires and billionaires, but that's something that they're keeping in the bill. So, you know, it's quite a constituency.
Yeah, that's right. And houses, too. It can keep houses of unlimited value as long as they bought them 3 1/3 years before filing for bankruptcy.
Right.
You know, why it should be okay to stash millions and millions in a house as long as you bought it 3 years earlier is not clear to me. But that's the way the bill's written. And you're right. It's not just the credit card companies. The Chamber of Commerce has been lobbying for this bill. And all of corporate America seems to like the bill. And their servants on the Hill. And, you know, we saw so many good amendments proposed in the Senate and voted down that tried to make the bill a little bit more humane. What we expect to happen tomorrow afternoon in the Rules Committee of the House is that they put this out to the full House without allowing any amendments. And so we are urging people to phone the Republican members of the Rules Committee and demand that they put the bill out in an open rule format that allows the amendments and discussion. Because what they want to do is just simply pass the Senate bill without a word said, get it to the president, and put it in effect. And
So the simple way of saying this would be, for someone who's contacting the member of Congress, would be to say, would you please make sure that the bankruptcy bill gets out before the House in a way that it can be debated and amended.
Right, right. Particularly if they're on the Rules Committee, and you can go to debtslavery.org and you'll see who that is.
Do you have a list right there in front of you?
Oh, sure. Let me see. Hang on 1 second. With any member, they should come out publicly now against this bill and commit to voting the right way.
So be sure to call 1-877-SOB-USOB and get your member of Congress on the line or a member of their staff and say, you know, we do not want you to support this bankruptcy bill in the House of Representatives. Now is the time to call your congressman, not your senator. So the Senate has already voted on this, unfortunately.
That's right. Here's the list you asked for. These are the Republican members on the Rules Committee. We expect the Democrats to vote the right way on this in the Rules Committee. The Republicans are David Breyer of California, Lincoln Diaz-Balart of Florida, Doc Hastings of Washington, Pete Sessions of Texas, Adam Putnam of Florida, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Tom Cole of Oklahoma, Rob Bishop of Utah, and Phil Gingrey of Georgia.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Those are the ones who can allow discussion and amendments or not.
Okay. So contact your member of Congress at 1-877-SOB-USOB, and do it now and or soon. Okay. What else can be done, David? David Swanson.
Well, we are organizing, we meaning debtslavery.org and our coalition members, particularly Progressive Democrats of America, we're organizing events around the country on Wednesday, protests at the offices of Democrats in the House who have committed to voting yes on the bill. We want to turn them around.
Mm-hmm.
And we will have probably later today up on our website information on where those events will be around the country. We also probably will have a press conference the same day, Wednesday, on Capitol Hill, with some Congress members willing to take a stand on this to try to sway others. So get involved, email your Congress member, phone your Congress member, and check out debtslavery.org, and get ready to turn out at noon on Wednesday in front of a Congress member's office to make your voice heard.
Yeah. Now, on another front, the National Labor Relations Board is Bush is pushing right wing appointees to this. This is the group that is supposed to advocate for labor, and the Financial Times today of London reported that the Bush administration, quote, aims to toughen its regulation of organized labor in what critics see as the latest in a series of pro-business policies sweeping Washington. Specifically, writes David Sirota today, political hacks at the Department of Labor, quote, plans greater scrutiny of spending and hiring practices and continue to increase sharply the number of financial audits of individual unions, end quote. I mean, this is incredible. This is all out war. These guys have declared all out war on the average working person in America. They're shipping our jobs overseas, and those of us and those who are unionized, who are members of unions or advocate unionization, the democracy in the workplace, they're harassing them. I mean, how?
Yeah, what? That's exactly right. And it's not just that they're going to force unions to come up with all this extra paperwork and accounting. They're also likely to try to effectively ban card check organizing. This is the National Labor Relations Board is, and this means that you won't be able to get 50% plus one of workers in a workplace to sign cards saying they want a union and get a union.
Right.
On a voluntary basis from the owners.
Right.
It will just be out, and so you'll be stuck with having to do an election process. It takes years and years and endless stonewalling and is just unworkable these days. So there will be no more unions formed through the traditional paths.
Yeah. And what we're seeing, this is, I'm stuttering, David. I'm boggled by this.
It's overwhelming.
We are watching the povertyization. I don't know how to say it beyond that. The impoverishment, I guess would be the word. Of America, systematically, step by step, in an organized and concerted fashion, by a small cabal of right wing extremist multimillionaires. They're wiping out our country. It's just mind boggling. Okay, David, your website, debtslavery.org, davidswanson.org as well, and the Progressive Democrats for America. Their website is
pdamerica.org.
pdamerica.org. So people can find out more information on all these things. And once more, we want to encourage people, at least, you know, let's start taking a stand here. Contact your member of Congress at 877-SOB-USOB and tell them that you are absolutely and totally opposed to this so-called bankruptcy reform and want them to do something about it, no matter who your member of Congress may be. David Swanson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I do appreciate it. Good talking to you. Keep up the good fight. 20 minutes past the hour. Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Truth always deceiving, never believing in yourself. Whoa, truth.
As keeping democracy alive, even as corporations try to pull the plug and sell off the body parts, I'm Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. is on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's happening in Washington today?
Well, let's see. Quite a bit going on. The president had his mini press conference, two questions each aside, with the Ukrainian president. And I have to say, I was probably 15 feet from the guy. He does not look good.
Really?
You can really tell what... Yeah. this poison did to him. A couple other interesting things going on. The Supreme Court today unanimously decided that creditors cannot seize individual retirement accounts of those filing for bankruptcy.
Oh, interesting. So your IRAs are protected.
Right. 401Ks, Social Security benefits, and pensions are already shielded from that. But the IRA, you know, can be withdrawn at any time. There's a 10% penalty if the person who has the IRA is not 59 and a half.
Right. Now, that's this, you know, for the average middle-class folks or working-class folks, that's sort of the good news. The bad news is that you can only contribute up to, what is it, $3,000 a year into an IRA?
Three or four.
Yeah, it's gone up.
One is the 401K is four. I can't remember.
Yeah, but whatever it is.
You're right. One of them, but
it's just a few thousand dollars a year.
Right.
Whereas if you're a millionaire or a billionaire, you can create an asset protection trust and put hundreds of millions of dollars into it. And
it's shielded.
And it's absolutely shielded from bankruptcy under this new bankruptcy legislation. So, you know, Kenny Boy Lay, he'll be covered. George Bush, should he ever decide to go bankruptcy.
He's worth $20 million still after all this.
Yeah, I mean, and
even if he goes down to $2 million, I don't feel bad for him.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so there's
a couple
that.
Other things. Well, the main thing, actually, is Grover Norquist, who just got married on Saturday. He's doing a press conference today. As you know, he runs Americans for Tax Reform, and Grover is doing a conference at the press club as we speak, talking about how they are trying to get the Republicans to invoke the nuclear option in terms of judges and Supreme Court judges, and they want to have it in place by the time they need a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, I have been saying all along that the Social Security rhetoric from George Bush is not about Social Security. It's about convincing the generation of people under 30 that privatization of all things is good, and that the Terry Schiavo thing was not about Terry Schiavo. It was about convincing Americans that the judiciary is out of control, and therefore the Bill Frist should exercise the nuclear option, and the Republicans should go ahead and put in, you know, crazies into the judiciary. And here's the proof it's happening, just as I predicted.
Exactly.
Incredible.
Exactly. Pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah. Oh, well, in a way.
That's the story in terms of Norquist, but they're really talking about how they've got the 51 votes, how they're working with people. I mean, they're being evil.
Evil.
Yeah. Evil, as I say.
Yeah. For the nuclear option to be invoked, all they have to do is institute a rules change. That requires a simple majority vote, right? 51 votes.
That's right.
So the Republicans
have. They say they've got the votes.
They say they've. Whoa. Yeah.
And now it looks like the president says that he is going to support and campaign for Lincoln Chafee in Rhode Island.
Oh, that's interesting. Why?
He's a Republican. Republicans have a big tent.
Yeah, but he's a liberal Republican.
I would actually expect that would work against Chafee in Rhode Island.
Yeah. It may. A lot depends. I don't know the politics of Rhode Island, but yeah, interesting. Okay. Well, so that's what's happening in Washington, D.C. today.
Yes, and as you know, the president is going to be going to the Pope's funeral.
Yes, yeah, and his wife, I assume, as well, Mrs.
Absolutely.
Bush.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, thank you so much for the Daily Report, and we will talk with you tomorrow. Have a good one. 29 minutes past the hour, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom Hartman, one of the major mental health care providers for liberals in America and for conservatives. Welcome back to our program. 27 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in San Diego is on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Good Good morning, Tom. I think I found the underground Democrats.
Okay, Scott, you're going to have to speak up. You're awful faint.
I said I think I found the underground Democrats.
Okay, where are they?
They're hiding out as administrators of pension funds, and they're having a huge impact on policies throughout Wall Street. And it's aggravating and angering our dear beloved governor here, who wants to get rid of.
That's why the Herr Gruppenführer is trying to do away with the state pension funds. We're trying to convert them in such a way that the people who administer them cannot use them for political purposes.
Right.
You know, by supporting
Phil Angeles. He's the guy that heads up both the CalPERS and the CalSTARS, which is a state teachers retirement system.
Right.
And Arnold is trying to get rid of this guy. They're using some bureaucratic maneuvers to pull these guys out of the way, and they've already gotten rid of one of them. Harrigan was ousted from his position. I think he was with the AFSCME.
Mm-hmm.
Again, another pension board. But the governors are trying to get rid of these guys because they're making some differences. They're really upsetting people on Wall Street.
Yeah.
You know, the Vermont Retired Teachers Association recently wrote a letter and pulled their funds from any Wall Street firm that was providing backing for the privatization.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I understand, Scott, and I agree with you. And this is a serious problem, and it's one that I hope gets a whole lot more play in the California press, because Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger there, he has really taken the lead on this thing. I mean, he's really charging gung ho ahead with this. And I have this horrible feeling the average person just, you know, so much these cons have been throwing so much stuff out. I mean, tomorrow the energy bill is going to be introduced in the House of Representatives, for example. We'll get to that in a minute. But I mean, it's just like it's just one thing after another. And people, I mean, people haven't even had time to absorb the impact of the ban on class action lawsuits, for example, from the week before last. And then last week it's the bankruptcy bill, and then this week it's the energy bill. And in the middle of it, you know, the Pope dies, and in the middle of that, you know, you have to be careful who you elect, because they will do what they want to do. And as somebody in our chat room noted a little earlier, isn't it interesting, under Compassion of Conservatives, we have more hungry children, more people dying in the United States. It's a tragedy. Scott in Dallas, Texas on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today? I'm sorry, it's John in Dallas, Texas. Is that John?
It's John in Dallas, Texas.
Hey, John. Sorry about
that.
How
you doing?
Good. It was Scott in San Diego. His last call. I'm reading the screen wrong. I'm fine. What's up?
Okay. I'm hearing an interesting comment from my Republican legislator here in Texas. You know, we're struggling for money, and what they're looking to do, one of the ways is to increase the sales tax. I tell him that the sales tax is a very regressive tax, but now he comes back with another thing, saying that, well, it really isn't as regressive as you think. Because even though that the poor people are paying an increased amount in the sales tax, the benefits from the CHIPS programs and you know, various other state programs, they're actually going to get back more than what their actual increase amount is.
Huh?
And well, that's sort of what I said, so I thought I'd ask you.
Yeah, well, you know, what he's saying basically is that, yes, the sales tax is regressive, but not just the poor pay it. You've got billionaires paying it and millionaires. So if somebody buys a yacht, you know, it puts a little bit more money into it. And as a result of that, the funds that are being used from the sales tax to finance programs for the poor and the working poor are getting some of their money from wealthy. It's a nonsense argument. It's the kind of bizarre logic that isn't even a justification. I mean, it's weird. It's to say, yes, it's a regressive tax, but by the way, it funds something progressive. You know, it's like that. Hey, let's talk about the fact that it's a regressive tax to begin with. I mean, Jefferson, for example, in his letters in the late 1790s, was writing, and actually after he was president in the early 1800s too, when he was translating Desuet de Tracy's book, was writing about how a person should have to pay no tax at all on the basic income that is necessary to maintain their style of life. That is to pay for their housing and their children's education and medical expenses and food and clothing and things like that. And that only people who have wealth beyond the necessities for an average lifestyle should be paying taxes. I mean, this is Thomas Jefferson.
Any taxes at all, yeah.
Yeah, any taxes at all. And that was the original idea. I mean, if you look at the original threshold set for example, income taxes, they really didn't hit working people. It hit the high end of working people and on up. And now, of course, inflation has put more and more people into these tax brackets, into these lower tax brackets. But the sales tax is absolutely the most regressive of all the taxes because most people who work for a living, I think it's 97% of people who work for a living basically spend everything they make every mm-hmm. year. And you know, at the most, they're saving 1 or 2 or 3%, but even that's a lot. And so because they're spending everything they take in, much of that is spent on things for which they have to pay sales tax.
Yeah, even though that there's exemptions for like food, you know, various food items.
In some states, not in all
drugs
states.
And that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But still, the other subsistence things are still there.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, did he send you a letter about this?
No, in fact, I sat down and was talking with him, and then he came out with this idea, and I was tongue-tied because, you know, I said, well, you know, it's an interesting concept, but I don't really see it.
Yeah.
You know, and he says, well, no, the thing is that it's not that regressive because if you take the poor as a group, they're actually getting, from the increased sales tax, they're actually getting back more in programs than what they're paying into it.
Well, what you'd have to do is you'd have to look at all the things that the sales tax is funding.
Yeah.
And the sales tax in most – is this a state sales tax you're talking about?
State sales tax, yeah. Okay. And it's going to be the highest in the nation.
Right. So generally your state sales tax is funding a whole bunch of things beyond services for poor people, and including, for example, to a large extent, it's funding things like welfare to large corporations. You see this thing where Boeing was shopping states. This was 2 years ago where they said, okay, we're going to move our headquarters from Seattle. What state's going to give us the biggest deal or the best
deal? And Dallas here was trying for it.
Absolutely. And Chicago and as I recall, Miami. I mean, there were three or four cities that were saying...
Yeah, they finally resolved on Chicago.
Yeah, that's where they ended up. But there were three or four cities that were saying, oh, we'll give you tax breaks. We'll give you tax credits. You won't have to pay tax. You know, well, where's that money coming from? It's coming out of the sales tax, right? Or it's coming out of the state income tax.
We don't have income tax here.
Oh, what state are you in?
Texas.
Oh, that's right, Dallas, Texas. Yeah, you're in Texas. Yeah. Okay. So the government is basically funded entirely by the state sales tax. So that's paying for the stadium that George W. Bush had built so that his baseball team would be worth more money.
That's right.
That's paying for a whole lot of things that are not just serving the people who are paying the majority of regressive sales taxes. That's an insane argument. It's just, you know, that's just a nutty argument.
Yep.
Okay, John, thanks for the call.
Appreciate it.
You know, keep on him. And keep spreading the word. Hey, how can these guys say this kind of thing? Here we have tomorrow the energy bill, depending on, you know, on how Congress moves, but it's scheduled for tomorrow. This from Public Citizen. And this is what Ralph Nader should be doing with his life instead of running for president, is starting groups like Public Citizen, which he did start. I mean, he needs to be starting more of them. But here we have energy corporations with a record of cheating consumers form new lobbying group to influence energy policy. Four of the six corporations have paid nearly $1 billion to settle allegations of market manipulation. And this is just, you know, just to lay it out, a lobbying group formed by six energy companies is lobbying the federal government in an effort to convince lawmakers and regulators that deregulation is good for consumers, despite the fact that these companies have paid nearly $1 billion over the past 3 years to settle allegations of Enron-style market manipulation for acts they were able to more easily commit because of deregulation. One company is under criminal indictment for its role in intentionally shutting down power plants in California. Also an act it was able to commit more easily because of deregulation. The energy bill is due to be introduced in the House of Representatives tomorrow. The Public Utility Holding Company Act will be repealed. This is a consumer protection law that limits the investment of utility profits in unrelated business ventures and prohibits expansion-minded corporations from siphoning off profits for risky investment schemes that do nothing to improve service reliability or keep electricity rates low. See, here's the bottom line. This comes back to the whole issue of what is the commons and how do you protect it. And back during the Roosevelt administration, during the Great Depression, as electricity was spreading in various cities, in the rural areas, in the urban areas in particular, because it was profitable. I mean, you could electrify 100 homes on a city block, you know, or 100 residences in a city block of Manhattan, for example, rather than going out to the countryside of upstate New York, where, you know, you might have to go 10 miles to get 10 residences. Okay, so the utilities, who were in the business of making money first and providing electricity second — they were making money by providing electricity, but their whole thing was to make money by providing electricity — they said, you know, we're not gonna provide electricity to folks out in the rural areas. It's too expensive. And so Roosevelt created the Rural Electrification Administration, the REA, and said, you know, okay, here's an agency. We'll use tax dollars to make it possible for you guys to reach, you know, we'll help pay for the wires. We will bring electricity to everybody. Now, in exchange for that, you cannot price gouge these people. Your ability, because you're going to have a monopoly. We're going to put up the wires, but you're going to be the only one supplying the electricity on those wires because you have a monopoly. We get to regulate the price that you charge. And we'll make sure that you can make a profit. But we will also make sure that you're not going to be robbing people blind. And that's, you know, by and large how it's been, more or less in various forms and ways in most states ever since. And now here under this energy bill, let's deregulate that. Let's do away with this. This is what they did in California. They deregulated into the energy. They said, well, we don't need the government to look over the shoulders of these power companies anymore. And what did you get? Rolling blackouts. You got 1,000% increase in energy prices. You got energy shortages. You got traders at Enron laughing about how they're pulling the plug on grandma. I mean, this is outrageous. And the Republicans want to do more of this. Oh, let's just deregulate. Deregulated electricity. Deregulation has been a demonstrated failure, with prices for this essential commodity, that being electricity, rising faster in the 15 deregulated states than in the 35 states that remain regulated. Very simple. This is not rocket science. It's like, you know, if somebody's the only source of something, they can charge whatever they want. People have to have electricity. And if we, the people, aren't going to protect ourselves, who is? You think corporate America is going to protect us from them? Somehow I doubt it. The public citizen, says in their press releases, veterans of past deregulation fiascos, these companies have already paid nearly $1 billion to settle allegations of market manipulation. Houston-based Reliant Energy has paid nearly $125 million to federal and state governments for its role in intentionally shutting down power plants in California to drive up prices, which then gave them bigger profits. The company's also been criminally indicted by the Bush administration. Now, it takes a lot for a corporation to get criminally indicted by the Bush administration for price gouging. Atlanta-based Marant has agreed to pay $780 million to settle allegations of market manipulation. California-based Calpine has also agreed to a $7.5 million payment to settle allegations that have manipulated natural gas and power markets. And Baltimore-based Constellation Energy paid the California Attorney General's Office $2.5 million to settle allegations that it manipulated that state's electricity market. All of the actions that led to the payments were committed in deregulated markets. And so now we find that these companies, Calpine, Constellation Energy, Exelon, Mirant, PSEG, and Reliant Energy, have formed an organization and hired six lobbyists to pitch for deregulation at the federal level. So these other 35 states that have regulated power, that have power regulation, will be forced to deregulate. And what happened to states' rights? Yeah, the Republicans are not all that happy about states' rights anymore now that they're in charge of the federal government. And who are these folks that they have hired as lobbyists? William Massey, a Democrat, commissioner for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission from 1993 to 2004, and now a lobbyist with Covington & Burling. Don Nichols, the notorious former GOP senator from Oklahoma and Senate Majority Whip, now the founding partner of the lobbying firm the Nichols Group. Robert S. Walker, former Pennsylvania GOP representative from 76 to 96, and a founder of the lobbying firm Wexler & Walker. Jack Howard, former deputy assistant for legislative affairs to President George W. Bush. Oh, gee. And a former senior aide to Senator to House Speaker Denny Hastert, Newt Gingrich, and former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott. Howard is now president of the Wexler and Walker lobbying firm. Hazen Marshall, former top aide to Don Nichols, now a lobbyist of the Nichols Group, and Joel Molina, Democrat, a lobbyist with Wexler and Walker. We're going to bring these folks in. Now, in the meantime, Wall Street Journal reports Alaska regulators have backed allegations that British Petroleum PLC and one of its contractors twice failed to report spills of drilling fluids at the giant Prudhoe Bay oil field and are recommending corrective action from that state's attorney general. BP paid a fine of $716,000 to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission on behalf of a consortium of North Slope oil owners for violations related to a 2002 well explosion at Prudhoe Bay. Yeah, we really need to deregulate these guys. We just, you know, you can trust them. They're the energy companies. They're the folks, you know, they have CEO. You know, George W. Bush was an energy company CEO. Dick Cheney was an energy company CEO. There's an oil tanker named after Condi Rice. You can trust them. Let's just give our lives over to them. That's the plan. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show? What was it you wanted? Could you say it again?
And welcome back.
I'll be back in a minute. You can get it together by then.
Oh, amazing. I was looking to see if I still had those clips of the energy companies chuckling. No, I don't see it here. Somebody in the chat room had said, "Hey, can you play that thing?" Yeah, maybe we'll find it. Anyhow, welcome back. Thank you, Bob. Today, 26. Wall Street Journal recently reported on this. I think this is fascinating. Here's the positive note to leave this hour of the program on. Today, 26 former national security officials from Republican and Democratic administrations will send a letter to President Bush calling for, quote, a major new initiative to curtail U.S. consumption, end quote, by improving the fuel economy of U.S. autos and developing alternatives to fossil fuels. This is an article by John Fialka and Jeffrey Ball in the Wall Street Journal. The group is asking, the pitch to the federal government is set aside $1 billion, a billion, that's with a B, to come up with alternatives, you know, new kinds of energy, better, you know, alternatives to the existing oil-based, coal-based, all that sort of thing system. And let's get this show on the road here. Let's get something different. Let's, you know, some kind of useful energy policy that's actually going to it's actually going to make us independent. Why are we spending $400 billion to stake out the territory of somebody else's oil? I mean, it's beyond anything reasonable. The price of the pump is not all we're paying right now. We're also paying $400 billion for a defense budget, says Robert C. McFarlane, President Reagan's national security advisor and a signer of the letter. You get that? President Reagan's national, his Reagan's Condi Rice is saying we're spending $400 billion to protect our oil prices. Now, that gives you some clue as to why we're in the Middle East. Participants in the new lobbying effort say the emerging common ground across the ideological spectrum could make a difference. C. Boyden Gray, former White House counsel to the first President Bush, says, I think the political heft is beginning to fall into place. This is incredible. Tax incentives for more energy-efficient cars, including hybrid, lighter-weight vehicles, cars capable of burning fuels that are 85% ethanol. Several advocates involved with the new discussion say Mr. Bush isn't working aggressively enough to cut oil use now. This from Republicans. It's Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Yes, Bonnie, Big Guy Arizona in the chat room, you're right. Bonnie is one of the most erudite folks in all of cyberspace. We have a great bunch in the chat room today. You can get there by going to tomhartman.com. If you want to call the program, our number 1-866-889-8894. Welcome back. Some time ago, a week or so ago, more or less, somebody had called me up and said, hey, what's Howard Dean up to these days? I have not heard anything about him since he became head of the DNC. And why not? You know, what's going on? And so I sent a note to Candy Stroud, who's with the Democratic National Convention, or committee, rather. She's the, I'm not sure of her official title. I've got her business card around here someplace, but something like, you know, the director of public relations or the official spokesperson or whatever you call it. And so I said, you know, Candy, what's going on with Howard Dean? And she sent me back this note. It says, Dear Tom, thank you for letting me know that what people are saying about Governor Dean. I know it might seem like he has been silent, but he really hasn't been. As you know, when Governor Dean was running for DNC chair, he promised to get the message out to the grassroots first. He promised to speak about the Democratic Party and the party's message, but to get the message out to the states first. He wants to speak about how the Democratic Party affects people's lives in their communities and towns. Also, he has stuck to his campaign promise, Governor Dean's activities since becoming chairman. He's a man of his word. He has visited 13 states, including red states like Mississippi, Kansas, and Tennessee. He's been interviewed for 13 local television outlets airing on 18 stations. He's been interviewed by 23 local radio outlets airing on almost 800 stations. He's been interviewed by 22 local newspapers, weeklies, and magazines appearing all over the country. The local AP reporter story is usually distributed on the National Wire. Interviewed by 9 specialty publications, i.e. African-American, Latino, etc. Participated in an online chat for the Democratic National Committee and raised over $650,000 for the state parties. Don't worry, says Candy, he won't stay away from national media forever, so please be patient and let me know if you have any other questions. That from Candy Stroud at the DNC. Just for those who are curious, and as I have said before, I am not a Democrat, and I'm not a spokesperson for the Democratic Party, although I'm increasingly convinced that the only way that that we're going to get this country back into any kind of rational course and any kind of rational policy is if the progressives and greens among us, if we progressives build alliances with, form coalitions with, and, you know, get inside of, infiltrate, participate with the Democratic Party. That's what it's going to take. We're going to have to do with the Democratic Party in order to take, in some rational way, take back this country and put it back on sound footing. We're going to have to do within the Democratic Party what the ultra-right-wingers did within the Republican Party. They took over the party. After Barry Goldwater went down in flames in 64, they said, hey, you know, we're gonna do this. And they did. And now there is, it's really interesting. There is a battle going on for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party, which is progressives, people like me, David Swanson, who was on last hour, folks like that, who are saying, David Sirota, these folks, you could call it, I'm reluctant to call it the Dennis Kucinich wing of the party. I would say the Franklin Roosevelt wing of the party. The classic Democrats, the Democrats who view the Democratic Party as the party of the average working person. Those folks are fighting a tooth and nail battle within the Democratic Party with the Clintonistas, the Clinton faction, the faction within the Democratic Party who created the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC Democrats. And, you know, to give them credit, when they first created it, it seemed like that was what was necessary to survive. But the DLC Democrats are the ones who say, hey, let's get in bed with the Republicans. Let's get in bed with the big multinational corporations. That's where the money is. That's where the power is. If you don't hang out with them, you're going to be marginalized on the outside. And, of course, Howard Dean in his presidential campaign demonstrated that that didn't need to be, that you can actually raise money from we the people, from average people. And Barbara Boxer has seen that same thing. And so there is a rise, I believe, in the old-fashioned Democratic Party. The Democrats are coming back. And interestingly, at the same time, there is in the Republican Party now an effort by people like Lincoln Chafee and Olympia Snow to take back the Republican Party. And to some extent, you could say John McCain. Although they're still, you know, they're still terrified of this, the power that the Bush administration wields. And how the Bushies, they take no enemies, they remember grievances, they punish. I mean, it's like trying to take on Stalin. It's the old story about how, you know, after Stalin died, Nikita Khrushchev came to power. And once Stalin was dead and buried and well buried, you know, a year or two after he was buried, it became acceptable for Pravda, TASS, the national news agency, and Pravda, the official newspaper, to start, and the other Soviet news agencies, to begin talking about the crimes that Stalin had committed, that Joe Stalin had committed. It even became fashionable for politicians to denounce Stalin's excesses. It was sort of like saying, you know, hey, we're good guys. It was just that one. It's the bad apple theory. It's the exact same thing that George W. Bush said about, you know, when Enron went down. Well, we don't have a systemic problem here. There's no problem of corporations taking over government or something like that. No, what we have a problem is a few bad apples. Just a few bad apples. And so, anyhow, it became fashionable in the Soviet Union to say that Stalin was just a bad apple. Nothing wrong with the communist system. Nothing wrong with the USSR. It was Stalin. And so Nikita Khrushchev is speaking to the Politburo, and these are, you know, elected officials, more or less, and he's giving this speech, and he says something about Stalin, something negative about Stalin. You know, that guy killed too many people. I mean, Stalin killed some 24 million people is one estimate. You know, I mean, Stalin killed not just during World War II. I mean, Stalin killed his own people, aggressively. As starting at the highest levels of government, I mean, having people assassinate his political opposition. So anyhow, Khrushchev says something about Stalin, something negative. And Khrushchev had been in the Politburo when Stalin was the one speaking before the Politburo. Right? He was an old politician. And so somebody in the back of the room yells, "Hey, why didn't you say something like that when you were back here in the Politburo? Why didn't you challenge Stalin then?" And Khrushchev looks around the room. And, you know, in a fairly reasonable tone of voice, he says, "Who said that?" And nobody answers, just dead silence. And so he looks a little harder and he says, "Who said that?" Still dead silence. He pounds his fist on the table. He says, "Who said that?" Absolute silence. Everybody's just terrified. And Khrushchev leans forward on the podium, on the lectern, gets his mouth right up by the microphone, and with a smile he says, "Now you know why I didn't speak out when I was sitting where you're sitting." Well, this is the situation that a lot of Republicans find themselves in right now. You speak out against George W. Bush, you speak out against the Bush administration, and you're toast. Not just you. I mean, they'll take your family down. They'll go after your wife. Look at what happened with Joe Wilson. They'll damage CIA operations. They'll take down your kid. Like when Colin Powell had a falling out, Bush says, "Okay, that's it. You're not going to speak well of us? You know, Colin Powell holds a news conference. He says something marginally negative about George W. Not 100% supportive. What's the first thing Bush does? He fires Michael Powell. He's not going to be FCC commissioner anymore. Well, of course, the official story was Michael Powell decided that he was going to go into the private sector and maybe somebody else will give him a job or something like that. But, you know, just a month before that, he had been saying he was looking forward to filling out his term another few years. Now, these guys play for keeps. We have, and they are committed to single-party rule. And I guarantee you Bill Frist will exercise that nuclear option. And the American people will go, where's the channel flipper? Where's the Simpsons? Right? Because so many people are just uninvolved. So many people have think their political education has been listening to right-wing talk radio or watching the corporate media on television, which is not going to talk about the real issues. It's not profitable to talk about the real issues. You're not going to find, you know, GE, which makes huge money every time we have a war, one of America's largest defense contractors. You're not going to hear on MSNBC or on NBC, you're not going to hear people saying, don't go to war. So, anyhow, I don't know how I got off on that. The point of that was that there is this battle going on within the Republican Party to take back the Republican Party, and there are to take it back to the ideals of Dwight Eisenhower and even Richard Nixon. I mean, it's oddly enough, Nixon was a crook, but politically, he would today be considered a liberal. I mean, he enthusiastically signed the legislation creating the EPA. Yes, it was the Democratic Congress that passed it and put it on his desk, but he could have vetoed it. He was, it's just incredible. And then, I'm going on and on here. Workers in office in dozens of cities around the nation demonstrated in front of the offices of Wall Street brokerage Charles Schwab and similar firms to protest the privatization of Social Security. Did you hear about this? Charles Schwab is part of a business coalition spending millions of dollars to push for privatization of Social Security. And because those firms stand to make billions if privatization happens. And so the union folks are out there, three members of, and at the same time, now down in Colombia, the militaristic, let's say, government we're supporting down there, three members of the Colombian Agricultural Trade Union have been assassinated. The Colombian Army claims that the three farmers were guerrillas killed in combat. It's a common claim made by the Army when they kill trade unionists. According to LaborStart.org, the three men were well-known political and peasant activists in the region. Colombia is considered one of the most dangerous places in the world for trade unionists. This is from the Workers' Independent News Service. It's a scary, scary business out there. I got to tell you about servicing the rich. What is up with the Bush administration? Just a few little shorts here. A few little short stories that are real eyebrow raisers. We'll get to those right after this. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number as well. 20 minutes past the hour.
2-7. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Who by powder? Who for his greed? Who for his hunger? Shall I say is calling?
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Who shall I say is calling? I think it's Armin in Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Maybe this would be another sales approach to project the negativity of the regressiveness of sales taxes.
Okay.
The way I would see it is explaining it to people to try to educate them. I'd say it like this. I'd say, the problem with sales taxes is the working class and the retired working class that don't qualify for the programs, like for the poor, they take it the shorts. And the people, the top 20% of all the people in this country at the top 20%, on an individual basis, they end up with 90 to 95% of all the capital that circulates in our economy. And when it stops circulating, they end up with control of it as equity and assets. So it works well for them. But what it does is it strips out what's left of the middle class, transfers it to the poor to use, and then when the poor are through using it and it circulates, the rich get even richer.
That's way too long, Armin. And here's how I would boil it down. I would say the sales tax is a tax that hits 100%. It's a 100% hit against working people, the working poor, and the retired people. And it's only a 5 or 10 or 15% hit on the wealthy, and it's only a 1 or 2% hit on the millionaires and billionaires.
It's not a hit on the wealthy, though. It's just temporary. It's only on paper, momentarily, that it's a hit on the wealthy, because you fail to realize that they own all the stocks, they own all the bonds, they own all the debt that's being serviced, they own all the assets.
Yeah, but they're
95%.
You know,
so when that capital circulates, you need to explain to people that it's basically a racket designed by them, for the most part, to benefit them, and explain how the money circulates and how it's designed to do what it does to further enrich them.
Yeah, and it's doing a very good job of it. It's you know, I don't disagree with you. I just don't think that most people are going to want to get into long, erudite discussions, and particularly the average person who just doesn't have a clue. But what I think everybody understands is that if you spend all of your income, and the main way that a state generates its revenue is a sales tax, you're supporting all of the functions of the state. You're the guy who's supporting the functions of the state. Whereas if much of your income you don't spend, you invest it, as the investor class does, then you're not supporting the functions of the state. I mean, you know, you make $1 million and you put 900,000 of it into stocks. You don't pay sales tax on stocks. So, you know, and you spend $100,000 on the cost of living for a year, so you got a pretty good lifestyle. So 10% of your income is actually you're paying sales tax on it. Whereas somebody who makes $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year, 100% of their income, they're going to have to pay sales tax on every time they buy something. The New York Times recently ran a story in which they were talking about how, well, here's what the quote. The IRS said that 80% of taxes owed but not paid by individuals were a result of underreporting of income, often by people working in the service sector. This is a rather misleading. David Sirota points out this is rather misleading. This is $200 billion, and it kind of implied that it was being stolen by people working in the service sector, like, you know, people who work for tips, you know, like the people who you know, waiters and waitresses and bartenders and whatnot. Well, when you go back to the actual IRS report, page 10 of the report breaks this down a little bit more. It says the underreporting of business income accounts for $100 billion of the tax gap, and underreporting of wages, salaries, tips, et cetera, accounts for $18 billion. Business income, of course, sole proprietorships, S corporations, wealthy lobbyists, sports agents, high-paid political consultants. So here we have, as David Sirota says, the media often reinforces dishonest stereotypes designed by conservatives to help the right wing pursue its ideological agenda. And the New York Times played right into their hands with this persecuted rich myth, reinforcing the idea that the rich are overtaxed and it's working people who are ripping off the system. Give me a break. Tom Hartman here with you, 29 minutes past the hour. Where being progressive never felt so good.
Radio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This is what thinking people do for fun. Hang out here. Hey, welcome to the program. Welcome to our chat room, to the folks there. Welcome to you. If you'd like to call in, our number 1-866-889-8894. Governor Jeb Bush, this posted by John on the thinkprogress.org website. This is the Center for American Progress's blog site. Governor Jeb Bush has been looking for ways to rein in Medicaid spending in Florida, which he claims is devouring the state budget. The governor has mentioned funding cuts and partial privatization as potential options. One thing he hasn't explored, kick Walmart off welfare. The St. Petersburg Times reports Walmart, quote, which is getting millions of dollars in state incentives to create jobs in Florida, has more employees and family members enrolled in Medicaid than any company in the state, end quote. The paper reports the state has paid Walmart more than $51 million in incentives since 1981. Can you imagine a politician coming to you, coming up and knocking on your door and saying, you know, I would like to, I just like your opinion on this. Would you like your taxes to go up so that we can give that money to Walmart so that they will locate a new Walmart in the state? Well, that's what Jeb Bush has been doing. $51 million. The state of Florida paid Walmart $51 million in incentives for 1981. By way of gratitude, the superstore is letting Florida taxpayers foot the bill for the 12,300 workers and dependents it pays so poorly that they qualify for Medicaid, the state's health care program for the poor. And Jeb Bush running around saying, Medicaid is going broke. There's too many people on Medicaid. 12,300 of them are Walmart workers. At the same time, he's running around going, we need to get more money to Walmart. Let's give them more tax dollars. $51 million isn't enough. Very strange. Very strange. 1-866, toll free across the United States. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Tom, in Minneapolis, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, are you in Oregon today?
No, I'm in Vermont. We're flying out to Oregon on Friday.
Okay.
So Friday will be a repeat show. And we're tearing the studio apart tomorrow and Thursday. We still haven't figured out what we're going to do for Thursday. But if it sounds like there's an echo, it's because this room is now empty, the studio that I'm in. And
I noticed that.
You noticed the difference in the audio quality, yeah.
A little bit.
Anyhow, so what's up?
Now, I just wanted to chime in and thank you for when you were talking about Dean returning the Democrats, and you mentioned to the FDR liberalism rather than the Kucinich liberal. And I think Dennis Kucinich would agree with you, since on his campaign website he had a photo of FDR.
Yeah.
And often I think Kucinich would, you know, people think of, tree hugger, pacifist type stuff, where we should not run away from invoking FDR's name. I mean, his image and his legacy is unassailable.
Oh, FDR is the patron saint of the Democratic Party, in my opinion. FDR, you go back through history and you look at the Democrats who really and truly changed the United States.
Exactly.
The founder of the Democratic Party, Thomas Jefferson, and Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah. Did you ever see this email that was circulated around the 2000 election? It was from a banker in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it was entitled, "What Has the GOP Done for the Worker?"
No, I didn't see it.
It was a great – I'm going to look it up and email it to you. It was a great story about how this guy, a banker at a party, was being assailed by all these conservatives, and he just came out and asked a simple question, what has the GOP done for the worker? And it was met with silence. And then he went off and listed all the New Deal programs and asked them, reminded everyone that the GOP fought tooth and nail against every one of those programs, right?
Right, but see – I would think that a banker at a cocktail party of other, millionaires and billionaires, why would anybody be silenced by that? I mean, wouldn't they be applauding the
fact? Yeah, he mentioned that about the FDIC, banking insurance, right?
Oh, well, yeah, there's that.
But, I had to remind them. And, again, I don't think Democrats or liberals, progressives, we do not invoke FDR's legacy enough, and we let the conservatives talk about Reagan, which is not even in the same league.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and what's so cool about the memorial services about the Pope right now is that so many people are pointing out that when Lech Walesa in Gdansk in Poland first wanted to start this union solidarity,
right?
He was on the edge.
Interesting that you brought that up.
It was
I was watching HBO Bill Maher on on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Bill O'Reilly as a guest, and he brought that up saying that he felt the Pope was more instrumental in bringing down the Iron Curtain than Reagan, and of course O'Reilly disagreed. And then Bill Maher brought up a great point saying, you know, it seems like the Republicans have decided to become the party of the Bible. Why don't the Democrats say we're the party of the Constitution?
Yeah, well, I think we should, or they should. I can't speak for the Democratic Party, and I agree. And the reality is that the Pope went to Poland, and he issued this encyclical, which I read part of in the first hour of this program, in which he said that the right to organize is a basic human right, and that labor precedes capital and is superior to capital, and the capital must always bow to labor, in as much as labor represents people. And
right.
Capital represents the accumulation of things, and that the side that the church must always be on is the side of the people. And the Catholic Church and the Vatican have not been at all reluctant to talk about, in quite outspoken fashion, their support for example, unionization. What is astounding to me is that almost none of that gets reported in the United States in the corporate media. What gets reported is their opposition to birth control.
Right.
Or their opposition to abortion, or, you know, what they think about Terry Schiavo or whatever. But nobody talks about the strong positions that the Pope has taken this last Pope has taken over and over.
You brought that up about capital versus labor. In that book, Wealth and Democracy, Kevin Phillips quotes Abraham Lincoln in one of the chapters.
Oh, yeah. I quote Abraham Lincoln unequal protection.
Labor is superior to capital
because it precedes capital, because you can't have capital until something is made, and you can't have something be made without labor.
I know.
It's very, very simple, and so just very straightforward. Tom, I appreciate the call. Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for calling in and keeping us on our toes here. And in tribute to FDR. Oh, let me finish this story, by the way. So the Pope goes over to Poland. And he gives his speech saying, hey, you know, labor unions have to be recognized. And the Communist Party at that point, they were paralyzed. They couldn't stop it. And that was the beginning of the end. That was the beginning of the end, when the Pope showed up in Poland to support Lech Walesa. And that led directly to the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that led directly to the end of communism. And Reagan just happened to be there. He was senile by the time it happened. Actually, it happened on George Herbert Walker Bush's during his presidency was the end of the USSR, not during Reagan's. But, you know, conservatives, they'll get it all messed up in any case. But here, just in memoriam or just to remember the four freedoms. This is the kind of stuff the Democratic Party should be coming back to. This is Franklin Roosevelt talking about the four freedoms, his famous four freedoms speech.
We look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world.
Except these days, George W. has modified that to say freedom of speech and expression except at any event where the president or the vice president are speaking, and there you have to go get a cage in a designated free speech zone, and if you leave, you can be shot.
The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world.
Except in the United States, where we're trying to say, no, this is just a Christian or maybe a Judeo-Christian, throw a bone to the Jewish folks out there, a Judeo-Christian nation. And therefore, everybody has to have the Ten Commandments in their schools and in their federal buildings and in great big monuments out in front of their courts and things like that. I'm just updating here, Roosevelt, for you in Bushonian speak.
Third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world.
Well, and that freedom from want that Roosevelt talked about, Bush has reinvented the compassionate conservatives. Now it's freedom to want. You're free to want.
The fourth is freedom from fear,
You know what Bush thinks about this.
Which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
And, of course, now it's freedom from fear. What? You could just hear Karl Rove chuckling. Freedom from fear. Oh, we're going to keep them terrified. That's how we win elections, you understand. Oh, my goodness. Jess in Atlanta, Georgia on the line. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hey, Jess, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you set me up pretty well for what I was going to get at.
Good.
Regarding the Pope and the whole notion of labor as the real value of a society's potential, particularly when there's masses of people. I actually plan to ask you, theoretically speaking, indulge me, humor me, if tomorrow you became the president, and even for the sake of argument, suppose Karl Rove and all his henchmen, you know, all his people and all the crazy Bush supporters, you know, Pat Buchanan and Billy Graham said, trust this guy, he's a good guy, listen to him. So you wouldn't even have to have any resistance. Do you think, what would be, I mean, I know you would implement all the principles of natural capitalism, but I mean, obviously that's a big answer you can't give us on the radio in 10 seconds.
You're talking about Paul Hawkins' book, Natural Capitalism?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but the part B of that question is, I would like to believe, for the sake of argument, that we don't have to wait for a miracle, because obviously tomorrow you're not going to be the president, or in 4 years, or whatever.
Nor ever, let me tell you.
Well, or even someone remotely.
Ain't going to happen, Jess.
But even someone remotely who thinks like you, such as Ralph Nader, perhaps.
Yeah.
And what I'm thinking is, I would like to believe that if people like good people like you, me, Ralph Nader, et cetera, and all us people who are maybe not as well-informed or as active as people who listen to you and Randy Rose, et cetera, but just general people who know enough that Bush's worst thing ever happened in civilization, if we could get somebody who speaks for all of them to be able to appropriate the podium, so to speak, and on a regular basis, on a daily basis, the press would be saying, okay, what's this guy saying today? What is the plan?
Well, Jess, I got to tell you, I think right now I am hoping anyway, that is the strategy that Howard Dean is going to be pursuing.
I think it has to be separate from Howard Dean, because there's such an aversion to the Democratic Party by a lot of people. It would have to be an independent, non-political type of speaker.
Then we're screwed, Jess. That's the thing. I mean, this is, you know, James Madison was so right in Federalist Number 10 when he warned about the danger of factions, because when they set up this country, they didn't know about, I mean, nobody had invented yet. It was John Stuart Mill in 1861 invented proportional representation. The idea of proportional representation had not even been conceived of. The idea of instant runoff voting didn't come along until the 1940s, 1950s. So they, you know, they created the best democracy they could. But the United States, Greece, and Australia, New Zealand, there's a handful of countries where really you can only have two parties. And if you have more than two parties, then you end up with minority rule. Now, the way that Australia and New Zealand got around that is they instituted instant runoff voting, and that's what we have to do here in the United States.
Well, I'm aware of instant runoff voting. I realize that's pretty much the key to a whole bunch of problems. But
yeah.
In terms of the masses, when you union, you have a union in a group of electricians, for instance. That's not a political group. But if you had a union of workers across the country that was like just, you know, 60% of the entire population or more, it wouldn't be political per se, but think of the power we would have being in an economic union.
Yeah, that was the merger of the AFL and the CIO back in the 30s, creating the AFL-CIO. And in 1947, or it was in the maybe it was in the 40s or 50s that the merger happened. But anyhow, in 1947, when the Republicans finally, in the election of 1946, got control of both the House and the Senate, and they passed the Taft-Hartley Act that allowed states to have so-called right-to-work laws, which you know allowed for union busting. Truman vetoed this thing. I mean, Truman said, no, you're not going to do this, and went back, and the Republicans in the House and Senate passed it over his veto. But in that year, 35% of Americans were members of unions. I mean, 35% of all working Americans. That's incredible. I mean, there was considerable political power there. The average working person having a voice, having an instrument through which they could speak. And we could
focus them all together. Did you happen to see here listen to Mike Malone on Friday night? We only took calls from teenagers.
Yeah, I think that's great. But you know, the point is that without having organized labor around, it's going to be more and more difficult for the average person to speak up. And this
that's
is
my
why.
Point. How do we get organized?
Well, that's my point too, Justin. I appreciate your call. Without that, without having organized labor available, then increasingly working people are not going to have a voice. And the way that and that's why the Republicans have declared war on organized labor. That's why they're passing rules. They're making rules changes. The Department of Labor is getting more hostile to organized labor. They're trying to do away with card check organizing. They're all these steps that they're taking to try and break the back of organized labor. What little of organized labor is left? I mean, it's down to between 8 and 9% of the private workforce in the United States. 11, 12, 13% of the total workforce if you include state and federal employees. And they're trying to do away with them. And the reason that they're trying to do away with them is because they are the last voice for the people. And we need to stand up and say, no, we're in favor of workers having a voice. And as I said, I don't see a third party ever being able to do it. You know, Teddy Roosevelt tried it. Look at what happened. Nader tried it in 2000. We have to take over the Democratic Party. I don't see any other solution. Somebody convince me of something else. I'll listen. But that seems like that's it. Take over the Democratic Party and then take back America. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
To lie takes a liar, it's to steal takes a thief. To lie to the whole world takes a liar in chief. He lies and he lies and he lies.
And welcome back. 6 minutes before the hour, 5.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our last day to kick around Rama Schneider. So I want to thank Rama for the 2 years here that he's been helping us out. Rama Schneider also has his own radio program, GRR Radio, grrradio.com, www.grrradio.com. And his program is on every Sunday night on the Internet. And he has been coming by here every Monday and line producing the program, and it's much appreciated. And Rama, thanks for all your help and everything you've done. We will hang out again, I'm sure. The Great Falls Tribune today shows exactly how far to the right the conservative movement has moved. This is posted by David Sirota on the ThinkProgress.org. Right-wing legislators in Montana have come down on the side of abusive tax shelters. On the side of it! Yes, we're in favor of abusive tax shelters. Voting against common sense legislation to close these loopholes being taken advantage of by tax evaders. As the Tribune, this is the Great Falls Tribune, this is the newspaper in Minnesota, or in Montana rather. As the Tribune notes, the bill they are opposing, quote, goes after illegitimate income tax shelters by requiring businesses and individuals to file additional information on transactions that may be taxable. It says those who fail to provide such information shall pay a $10,000 fine for an individual and $50,000 for a business. It also attempts to crack down on those avoiding capital gains taxes on real estate sales, and it targets Montana people or businesses who establish residency in the state without income taxes for the purpose of selling property so they don't have to pay Montana income taxes. This is like, remember when George Herbert Walker Bush kept his residence in Dallas, and it turned out that he just had an apartment there that he visited twice a year or something like that, but he didn't have to pay any income tax for decades because he called himself a Texas resident, even though he was living in Kennebunkport. And Gary Trudeau had that, you know, fill in the blank. Yes, I want to be a resident of Texas. You know, all I have to do is fill out this form. You know, I thought that was kind of cool. It was something possible. Hey, Rama, see if that mic out there, you know, flip the switch and make sure it's on and say hi. I think I've got you potted up.
All right, hi.
There you go. Hey, so I just want to say thank you, Rama.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And like I said in the chat room, Tom, people are moving on to bigger and better things, so there's no sorrow in this parting. We're all going up in the world.
There you go. Onward and upward. Thank you, Rama. Okay, so basically, here's the right-wingers saying if you're for abusive tax shelters that rip off regular taxpayers and rob state governments of revenue, then you're golden in Montana. All right, if you're a Republican, how much, you know, and for some reason, we call these people the right. Right? This isn't the right. This is the wrong in America. It's not the right. I mean, in January, Halliburton Products and Services Limited. This is from Andy Grotto on the same blog. And Oriental Kish finalized a contract to develop two sectors of the South Pars oil and gas field in Iran. Halliburton in Iran. A primary shareholder of Oriental Kish is none other than Sirius Nasiri, head of the Iranian delegation to the IAEA, negotiating the future of Iran's nuclear programs. Halliburton in bed with the Iranians. Yeah. But they're supplying our military. Oh, wait a minute. You find it confusing? Yeah. As the Tom Hartman program, where we factor out Bill O'Reilly, unilaterally invade Scarborough country and debate the sanity of Sean Hannity every single day. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.